Hello, everyone, and welcome back to People, Parasites, and Plagues, a podcast aimed at delivering information about the fascinating pathogens among us. I am David Peterson.
And I am Liliana Salvador, your host for today's episode. Malaria is one of the world's most deadly pathogens, with half the world's population at risk of contracting the disease. Across the globe, malaria exacts a toll on many of the world's poorest countries, and the lack of cheap, effective anti-malarial drugs is seen as a growing problem.
Our guest today is Dr. Belén Casera, an associate professor in the Department of Biochemistry and Molecular Biology here at UGA, and a member of the Center for Tropical and Emerging Global Diseases. Her research focuses on discovery of new drugs to prevent and treat malaria, as well as understanding how these drugs work and how parasites can sometimes become resistant to them.
Belén, you began working with malaria as a graduate student at the University of São Paulo in Brazil. Did you have interest in drug development then, or did that come later?
Hello, everyone. First, thank you so much for having me here. And that actually is it's a nice question, because actually I've been interested in drug discovery since I believe I was a child, because I'm originally from Argentina. And back home, one of my aunts, they own a pharmacy. So I remember going to the pharmacy as a child, and for me it was always fascinating. Going there is how all that was discovered, how people developed them. And I always had this desire to actually become a scientist and work in those therapeutics and understand how they are developed. So when the opportunity came to do my PhD in malaria, was a nice way to complement my interest in drug discovery, but starting to understand how infectious diseases, and especially parasites, which are much more complex organisms within infectious diseases, could be killed by molecules.
Belén, there's currently a number of drugs approved for treatment or prevention of malaria, but how great is the need for new drugs?
I guess it's huge, because fortunately the parasite has developed resistance to every single anti-malaria that has been deployed to the field, including artemisinin, which is the golden standard for treatment of malaria in combination with other drugs. And that possibility that the parasite can develop resistance even to new molecules. As a community, we need to stay ahead of the curve of drug resistant development. So I will classify it as a huge.
So I've got a slide I think I use in one of my lectures that shows a timeline of when antimalarials were first used and when resistance to them, you've probably seen that, when resistance to them developed. And it's kind of shocking.
It is. The parasite, and depending on the molecule, can go a couple of decades to just a couple of years. And many factors play into that. But the parasite has an ability to overcome drug treatment by resistant mechanisms quite fast.
That is fascinating. And also, when we listen to talks on drug development, we usually hear terms like hit and lead. Can you explain these different terms and walk us through the drug development process?
Sure. Well, the drug discovery process is very lengthy, and you can start by screening thousands and millions of small molecules that we call compounds or potential hits. And so the first thing when you are screening, that you are searching through this sea of molecules and these big libraries, when you identify one potential compound, depending on what you are looking for, usually for infectious diseases and in the case of parasites, you can do that search, but what we call a simple phenotypic screening. You're looking for things that we kill or not kill. And that particular molecule or compound that will specifically kill the parasite is what you identify as a hit. So that will be like when you think in a road trip, like the first station where you will stop. And you say, well, I have identified a good spot where to stop. And then what you need to do is once you select that spot is start to study the spot. That means study the molecule. And so you start to look at how the chemical structure relates to the effect on the parasite or the disease that you are trying to study. And that will involve that actually it's not the heat, it's not the perfect molecule to go as a therapeutic. The heat means that you identify something that you can start a study and modifying the molecule in order to move forward toward a lead. A lead candidate is already a molecule that has been going through toxicity studies. You understand not necessarily the mechanism of action, that means how the molecule kills the parasites, but at least you have a good amount of knowledge about the safety, okay? What you want in the difference between a heat and a lead is that the heat is giving you a killing effect. But still, there may be some issues regarding safety. When you move into the lead, you already have a greater knowledge about how it works beyond a test tube in the lab, but actually how it may act in a whole organism, just on a small animal, let's say a mouse. And you start to understand the safety. And that lead compounds is what it will be close to a preclinical. That means that you will enter in that stage when you want to optimize that molecule to be as potent as possible and as safe as possible. So when you study in drug development, both at the heat level or at the lead level, is that potency versus safety.
So does that mean that when you start the drug development process that you have several potential hits and several potential leads?
Yes. Don't put all your eggs in one basket. So it's good that you will have different hits. What you are looking in, when you select hits in a drug discovery campaign, what you want is chemical diversity, because along the way, many hits will be actually retire or abandon because they may present toxicity and liabilities that cannot be solved through medicinal chemistry, or it would require a lot of work in order to make it safer. And so you start with different hits. And ideally is that you will have several, but it's not always the case. And there is one saying that once you select a hit, in order to become a lead, that lead will not end up landing too far from the original molecule.
So, Belen, historically, a lot of antiparasitic and antimicrobial drugs were first identified as natural products made either by plants or microbes. What are the advantages and disadvantages of looking for antimalarials in natural products?
Natural products per se have the advantage that you use nature as your chemical library for searching. So the diversity that you can find in nature is amazing, okay, compared with the chemical space. So the disadvantage is that once you identify a good antimalarial, just was the case of artemisinin, natural products has the tendency to have very complex chemical structures. And what that means and why is that a problem? Especially in the case of antimalarials, you want something that you can produce in huge amounts. Think about that we have 200 million cases per year. So that means you need at least 200 million doses, okay? So you need to be capable to have a high production. That is usually better if you have a chemical compound because that you can scale up the production. In natural products, when the chemical structure is too complex, reproducing what nature does in a plant or in a microbe through chemical synthetic steps is not always possible because it's too complex and sometimes requires too many steps. more steps you add, more expensive your molecule will be. And in the case of ultimalarial, the cost of the drug is important. It has to be cheap. So unless you can cultivate a plant in big fields, then still you need to extract the molecule and make a big production. And still you will rely on plants and farming to obtain the main product. So that will be one disadvantage and why still the synthetic chemistry will be the best approach for especially antiparasitic drugs, because you can find a way to produce it in a cheaper way. Another disadvantage, if you think in terms of production, is that when you rely on something that has to be produced in the field, unless you are using a microbe, okay? And I'm talking that will be a major disadvantage with plant, because microbial production or therapeutics that are coming from microbes is a little bit different, because still you can produce those microbes in big reactors. Or in many cases, people can identify the way that the microbe produces that molecule and then the genes that are involved. And then you can re-engineer other microbes, such as a simple bacteria or a simple yeast, to produce that molecule in a reactor.
And part of the malaria drug research is to determine the mechanisms behind of how parasites become resistant to drugs. So why is it important to understand these mechanisms and how can we uncover them?
I will say that the most important reason is that because help us to stay ahead of the resistance that will be developed. And if you identify that before deploying that molecule into the field, you can use understanding the mechanism of resistance as part of your development to improve your molecule to actually avoid the resistance. So in many cases, if you are able to understand how the resistance will be developed, you can modify those molecules to stay away from the resistance. In other cases, it will be advantageous to know if the molecule will develop resistance in understanding how long it will take in the lab to develop. So there is not an exact correlation when you don't need to make much of the effort to develop resistance in the lab. So the chances that will occur in the field or in a patient, so those are greater than if you try and try and try and you cannot develop resistance in the lab. And more we understand the different mechanisms that the parasite has to avoid these molecules or become resistant to these molecules, better we can surveillance in the field for these resistance to develop. And then take that again to our advantage is more we know how the tools that the parasite, let's call it tools, will have to avoid these molecules, better we can try to rationally design or overcome those resistant mechanisms.
So I've got a really easy question. What makes a good drug target?
A really good drug target. The first answer that also I always teach in my class will be that target that is absent in the human host or sufficiently different. So if you find something that is exclusive for the parasite and exists only in the parasite, but is not present in the human body, and that includes our microbiome, because we are more bacteria than human cells. And so when we think in terms of toxicity, we all usually focus in the human part, but we forget that our interaction with our microbiome is so important. And that's the major side effect of usually antibiotics that will give you diarrhea or upset your gastrointestinal system. So that will be the ideal target. And also that it has to be essential for the parasite. That means that the parasite cannot survive at all with that target. However, not all potential targets that have those qualifications that are absent in the human or are sufficiently different that you can rationally design or identify something that will be more selective to the parasite versus the human are always what we call druggable. That means it doesn't mean that you will be able to identify either an, a small molecule or a therapeutic that will block that activity and therefore kill the parasite.
Essential and different from the host, but even then, maybe it won't work.
Yes. There is a saying in the pharmaceutical field that you need to fail fast and fail cheap. So sooner you identify that if your drug target is a drug target or can be druggable, that it will save you money and time.
Did we find that for malaria? Do we have those type of drugs that only focus on the parasite and don't focus on the human part?
Well, you can look at this in two ways. As a drug target, let's say as a protein, it's something, a function in the parasite that is completely exclusive of the parasite that you will not find in the human. Yes, there are some examples. However, I will not say the same for the therapeutic component. I will never say that a molecule is not toxic at all, because we don't know everything about our body. And each body reacts in a different way. And sometimes people have diverse reactions to a particular treatment. I react differently from another person, but in terms of the target, there exists. So that is exclusivity. From the drug point of view, I always cautious.
And some drug development efforts, screening compounds against the whole organism. Others focus on just one metabolic pathway. What are the advantages to each approach?
Well, it depends actually how you develop that screening assay, okay? So the assay will be that experiment that you will perform in the lab to survey different libraries of small molecules in the search of a hit. So if you're using the cell-based assay, without a particular target, has the advantage that you start knowing that it kills and that it works right in the context of a cell, okay? Now, you can still work with a particular metabolic pathway and still use the whole cell-based assay for studying and searching for new molecules. The advantage in that case will be that you already know, or you can focus and narrow your mode of action. So you, in that case, you do not only know that it's killing, but also you know how it works. Now, in the other, when you go just by a simple phenotypic screening, the disadvantage is that you don't exactly know how it works. So not knowing how it works is when you then when you start to study the safety, it will be, despite you have certain parameters that you can evaluate to say, okay, despite I don't know how it works, it has a general safety. Knowing how it works allows you to understand better the safety of a molecule and how that may have other interactions in the body. But again, it's not a strict rule. Knowing the target also allows you, or a metabolic pathway will allow you to design different strategies to make sure that the parasite will not overcome that particularly therapeutic. It has the advantages and disadvantages. And another that I will say that it will be an advantage of screening the whole cell is that you are not limiting yourself to a particular target. So you can be more broad in yourself. If my goal is to kill the parasite, and then it could be by any mechanism. When you focus on a metabolic pathway per se, you are limited to find something that just works there. But But today we have so many resources such as artificial intelligence that when, despite it's a little bit scary, the word of artificial intelligence, computers can help us now to design or identify molecules that will work specifically in a certain protein or in a certain mechanism.
Well, actually, that segues perfectly into a question I wanted to ask, because in one of your talks, I heard you mention something I think was called virtual drug screening, which sounds super cool. And I think that's what you're probably referring to here with the AI-assisted part of that. So if you could tell us about that.
Yes, we do work with one of our collaborators is with a company in California that they develop their special programs and softwares to literally what you use is what we call a computational chemist and a computer. And depending on the information that you have, for example, if you do have a particular drug target that you know the structure of that particular protein, let's say, then you can use computers to search for molecules that will interact based on certain things that you tell the program to look for. Or you may have, for example, a molecule, but you don't know the target, and you can use that to look for other molecules that will have a similar structure, and maybe those other molecules has been more studied and you may use to either study their mechanism or even identify a new drug. So the advantage of this is that it's much faster, because in a lab, what we call the wet lab, you need to go and do the experiment, and it's the cost. It's much more expensive to screen compounds directly just in the lab than using computers. And so when you combine time and how fast you can screen and how much will cost you, the overall cost of these virtual ligand screenings is become really beneficial.
And how many compounds might you test in a virtual ligand screening? Is it fast enough that you can do thousands or tens of thousands, or do you do more? Or
you test millions?
Oh my goodness!
Yeah, that's the big difference. And when you think how much it will cost you to test millions of compounds in vitro versus in silico,
that would be a lot of 96 well plates in the lab.
Yeah, you probably will go actually to more wells per plate, like the 84.
The power of artificial intelligence. And Belen, last year you were selected to take part at UGA's Innovation District Initiative. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, it was an amazing experience. This was what we call the Innovation Bootcamp for women. So we were only women. And I had the opportunity to be literally, it was a boot camp because it was around 6 weeks where we were exposed to the basics of entrepreneurship and what it means to start up a company. So we went from learning the language of the business world and how you go from having an idea and how to potentially commercialize that idea. And one thing that I really loved of this first experience is that we were women, that we were professors, postdocs, PhD students from a very diverse background. There were not just scientists, chemists, biologists, there was a lawyer or a musician. And how you take ideas out there. And for me, was eye-opening. I was the best decision was just to apply. And then the best that could happen that I was selected, because it changed completely my mind. Even if you had not ended up opening a company, I realized that my lab works as a company. It's like I do have a mind of an entrepreneur, because I manage budgets. I need to write for my ideas and ask for money to develop my ideas. And so kind of I need to sell my product to other people. And it was really amazing. It's just to understand how the business world works and what are the potentials that you have to either, if you have a product, make a decision. How do I want to go and open my own company to develop that product? Or after I have a patent, just I license that product to another company for developing and trying to get immersed in that world and understand how that works was eye-opening. So I will totally recommend this for especially young faculties or postdocs that are still also trying to figure it out, the career path. It was an amazing opportunity.
It really does sound like a fantastic program. And I agree with you, for younger investigators, grad students, postdocs, who aren't quite sure where their career will take them. It sounds like a just fantastic.
And I can also imagine the network. I am sure that probably you're still in contact and probably will be for many years with everyone that you have met through this program.
Yes, and I made amazing colleagues. And again, it's the networking, because actually we keep meeting this semester, and actually started, I believe it started last year. We kept meeting once a month to have actually a guest speaker coming from people that have for women they have experience in their careers, the innovation office, and all that the university is doing to actually incentivize, promote, and help faculties to bring their ideas to the market. It's just amazing. I'm so grateful for that at the university. We went through the patent experience with the office here at UGA, and they are always available to answer all the questions. And they literally walk you through the process. You just need to give them what they need, and it's amazing. They're really easy. They easy for you the whole process, which is it's a headache. So I'm so glad that we have such an amazing office here at UGA and all that the Innovation District is doing. I guess we are a leading university in terms of bringing ideas to the market. And I'm really proud to be part of that, to be part of UGA and this innovation program.
Very cool. So one other question. The WHO is once again getting serious about the idea that we might be able to eradicate malaria across the planet. And granted, this is going to be an effort on lots of fronts. So vector control and maybe vaccines, but how important will new antimalarials be in that effort?
Well, until we do have a fully protective vaccine or a working vaccine, which is getting there, there are good news coming out. New drugs, especially those that could be used as prophylactic, not just to treat the disease, but to prevent the infection, they were going to be critical. It's a lot of work ahead of us, and new drugs, I guess, will play a role to make sure that along the way, malaria will be eradicated. I really hope that it will become reality. I don't know if we will see it.
It's a tough problem, that's for sure.
I hope we do. Well, we are reaching the end of our episode. Our guest today was Dr. Belén Casera, malaria researcher here at UGA. Belén, thank you so much for being here with us.
You're very welcome. Thank you so much for having me.
Links to additional information about Dr. Casera's research can be found at our website at fid.uga.edu/ppp. Thank you for tuning in today. If you have any questions or suggestions for future episodes, reach out to us via email at ppp@uga.edu.
This podcast is brought to you by the Faculty of Infectious Diseases and the Grady College of Journalism at the University of Georgia. It is supported by the University of Georgia through the Office of the Vice President for Research and the College of Veterinary Medicine. Fire.